Good afternoon. You are tuned into It's Juno Afternoon here on Thursday, the March 3rd of March, the year 2016. Jeff Bauer, the affiliate for Joan Partis, who couldn't be here today because she's under the weather. We're talking with members of HARM, an Alaska musical ensemble, performing this weekend at the University of Alaska Southeast and at 360. Patty Hutchins Jopie will be here to highlight our first Friday show at the Jack Feathered Feats. We'll get a preview of Wrestling Jerusalem, a play about one man's journey to understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Colette Costa will be here to talk about the not-so-silent film screening at the Goldtown this weekend. And Nancy Nicerny will be here with Arne Sapp. That's Thursday on a Juno afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies, the isolated rain and snow showers in the evening, low temperatures around 33 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Blackfeet tribe is challenging Montana's Office of Secretary of State and local county commissioners about tribal members' voting access. Montana Public Radio's Corn Cates Carney has more.
The Blackfeet Tribal Business Council sent a letter to local officials in northwest Montana late last month saying the county doesn't offer equal voting access. Native American issues lobbyist and Blackfeet tribal member Tom Rogers says the Blackfeet often have to drive long distances if they want to cast a vote.
Native American tribal members in Montana have unequal access to voting, early voting, in-person absentee, late registration.
The Blackfeet's letter to county commissioners located just southeast of the reservation says off-reservation citizens have a 19-to-1 advantage over Blackfeet tribal members in ballot access.
We do not treat anyone differently, regardless of where they live in the county.
That's Ponderay County Commissioner Janice Hoppus. She says Ponderay County is working to improve voter access. Montana's Secretary of State office was sued in 2012 by several Montana tribes for not providing Native Americans with equal ballot access. This week, the Secretary of State office announced new satellite voting offices in 7 counties with reservation populations. Ponderay County was not one of them. I'm Corin Cates Carney in Helena, Montana.
Native Americans in North Dakota are among those who plan to attend a public hearing on the Bureau of Land Management's proposed rule to reduce excess gas venting and flaring on federal and tribal lands. Brandon Campbell reports.
As federal regulators consider new rules to curb gas flaring at oil wells on public and tribal lands, North Dakotans are being asked to weigh in at a public meeting in Dickinson today. In January, the Bureau of Land Management proposed the new regulations. This comes after years of outcry from tribal groups who argue that flaring excess gas is both an economic and environmental waste. Joletta Bird Bear with the group Fort Berthold Power is supporting the new rules.
If we can curtail health impacts to our generation and those coming behind us, we need to do that.
She says the BLM's new rules will ensure that tribal landowners will be compensated for gas that's burned off. Bird Bear says tribal governments also have lost out on at least $65 million in royalties, which could be reinvested in those communities.
Our road systems have taken just a tremendous degradation because of the heavy oil traffic. So those road systems really would benefit from additional revenue.
Opponents, including the American Petroleum Institute, say the tighter regulations could drive oil producers off federal lands. The public comment period on the BLM's new flaring rules lasts until April 8th. I'm Brandon Campbell.
March Madness is underway for Haskell Indian Nation University's ladies basketball team. The women won a championship game over the weekend. Rhonda Lavaldo caught up with the coach and players as they get ready for the national tournament and has this report.
With a historic win over College of the Ozarks for the Association of Independent Institutions Conference title, Haskell ladies basketball coach Shane Flanagan talked about the rivalry with a team his players had never beaten before.
It's been a long time coming for us, for this group, because we had a good year last year. We played Ozarks close every year, every time, so, you know, it's exciting.
Haskell player Tyler Sumter, Pyramid Lake Paiute, was named most valuable player for the tournament. Sumter talked about being role models for Native youth as the team continues to play on.
I think it's really cool that they get to watch us and like look up to us because we are all Native and we're at a bigger stage at Nationals. And I think we like kind of give them hope that they can make it and do it and come here and excel because we're all excelling.
Haskell drew a number 6 seed in the NAIA National Tournament and will face Dakota Wesleyan University, a number 3 seed, March 9th at the Tyson Event Center in Sioux City, Iowa. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. The Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations to the Wise Pies Arena, a.k.a. The Pit, April 29th and 30th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 8 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into a Juno afternoon here on Thursday, the 3rd of March. In the studio with us now, we have Rick File and Annie Bartholomew, members of the group Harm, who's performing this weekend at various places, including the University of Alaska Southeast at 7 o'clock tonight and at 360 tomorrow evening.
No, UAS tomorrow night and 360 North Saturday night.
I don't know why I'm so confused. I think it's Friday today.
Oh.
I'll be ready for the weekend.
Me too.
So let's talk about harm. What does harm mean in the first place mean?
Well, it's a project that was started like a little over a year ago. We started a year ago last October, and I had been playing with a couple bands around Fairbanks. One of them was Feeding Frenzy, and it was delightful and super fun, and we went on a really cool tour. And I came back from the tour just thinking, man, I love this, but I really want to do my own project. I have all these ideas, and I have all these melodies in my head, and I want to do something that's really more my own thing. And so I started an ensemble with my songs, and one of the members was Annie, who's sitting next to me here, Annie Bartholomew. And it was Heather Warren, Annie Bartholomew, Molly McDermott, John Heinz, and myself, Rebecca File. And so there is an acronym which with our names, which is HARM. But it's more than an acronym. It's also kind of wrapped in a lot of our concepts relate to harm and violence against women. The poetry for most of our songs is written by Heather Warren. And so there's a lot of themes of gender and sexuality and harm itself kind of involved with our songs. Also happens to be the front part of a lot of musical terms, harmony, harmonium, things like that. So it kind of has a lot of different layers to it.
You've got a lot of different instruments in the band. Do you want to list off a few of them?
I would love to. So we have, I play the harmonium and the banjo, and I sing. Annie plays the guitar, and she sings as well. We have four-part harmony, so there's a lot of people singing. And then there's also bass, as well as beatbox, clarinet, and cello.
Could you describe the harmonium, please?
I would love to. So the harmonium is it's originally a French instrument that was adapted into Indian culture. And it's kind of like an accordion that sits on a table. And you play it by squeezing air in and out with one hand, and then your other hand chords on it. And it is kind of an instrument that's made for harmony, thus the name harmonium. And so it's made to accompany voice, and it's used in Indian culture for a lot of chanting and singing and stuff like that. And it feels really wonderful to sing with. It's sort of like can really drown out your voice. It's loud. It's very droning. It's fun. It's basically like a tabletop accordion.
Where do you get your inspiration from?
My inspiration everywhere. Oh, man. I guess a lot of our music is very inspired by the environment of Fairbanks. It can be really dark and really heavy, but also has like brightness and intensity to it in certain ways. I am inspired by every kind of music, as is everyone in the group. Everyone's really eclectic, and I think it comes out in our sound, which is not easily to pin down. And you can't, it's when people say, you know, what do you sound like or what kind of music do you play? Maybe Annie, you have some comment on this, but it's hard to really say like what exactly it is. It's just harm.
Yeah, to me it sounds, we use the term psych folk, which is short for like psychedelic folk music, and a lot of the musicians who are inspired by Eastern Europe and those kinds of forms. But to me it kind of has these like chamber elements to it. When we started, there was an upright bass and a cello, and just the amount of sound that comes out of them is just really incredible to be on stage and be in the audience, too.
How does a song evolve?
How does a song evolve? Oh, well, for the most part, and this is open to reinvention always, but for the most part, I will compose a melody and maybe a vague structure, and then I'll present it to the group, and everybody will get to add their ideas or new sections. There are some songs that are composed that are my own original lyrics, but mostly the direction we're going is taking Heather Warren, taking her poetry, and she's a beatboxer, and transforming it from the poem itself, then becoming to me a musical idea, then becoming a song, then becoming a full ensemble song.
Would you consider Harm a political band?
Political band. I would not like to sort of label it any specific way. I think it's an experience. I would say it's a very emotional experience. And there are definitely political topics. Annie, I don't know if you have any comment on that, but...
You know, I don't think it's a bit of a political band. I feel like wanting equality for everyone and kind of that message of supporting women and violence against, or violence, you know what I'm trying to say. I don't feel like there's any political message. We're not endorsing any candidates. We're just telling the story of the struggles and challenges of living up north and identifying as a woman.
I didn't mean like a political candidate, but I meant some of the issues that are out there these days gives you a lot of fodder from which to make a song about.
Yeah, I think that you're right in a sense that there's a lot of way to relate a lot of the content to political issues. But in general, I like to think of it more as an emotional and healing experience for people. I mean, it's not exactly... it's a healing experience for us, I feel, and I think that translates to other people. So many people come up after a show who are crying and just like, oh my gosh, I didn't know I needed that, but I did, and thank you so much for giving that to us. And that's, to me, makes everything, all the grinding, all the getting around, it makes it totally worth it to see people who are like being healed, I guess, in a sense, by the music.
When did you first feel like you were a songwriter or a musician? Do you remember the first song you put together?
Oh, gosh. I think I had a little notebook when I was like 7 that I wrote pop songs in. But I've always been really like terrified of myself, and so I'd always like throw them away when I'd get like a year older, and I'd think, oh, this'll never fly, this'll never go platinum,
never,
you know?
Make it at the talent show.
Yeah. So I guess self-deprecation is really a part of being an artist. But I think when I was in high school, I think the moment you're speaking of, I saved up money and I got a laptop and a little tiny, like, cheap recording interface and the cheapest microphone I could get at the music store in Anchorage. I'm from Wasilla. And I recorded this song called Grace. And I still feel like it's one of my better works. I go back to it frequently and I don't understand how, like, my 16-year-old self created it or how it came out of me, but I think maybe that's the moment when I knew.
I'm talking to Rebecca File and Annie Bartholomew about Harm. They're performing tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Egan Lecture Hall at the University of Alaska Southeast, and they're also performing on Saturday. What can people hear during a typical show from Harm?
Well, we have a, like we've talked about, an interesting combination of instruments. We try to make our sets to be one really cohesive piece of art, so it kind of takes you on a journey of sorts. So it's really like, we don't really necessarily like to stop between every song and let everyone clap and do the like concert hall aesthetic. We like to have it be experiential for everybody. We want people, if they want to laugh or cry or dance, we want that to be a part of the experience for them. And we also have spoken word poetry woven, I don't know how I would say that, into the set. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on.
Yeah, we like to let the art speak for itself, and it really is an experiential thing. The arrangements can change based off of the tone in the room and the motion of the band.
And it's all happening tomorrow night and Saturday night. Tell me about the Saturday night concert, please.
Well, that's going to be a live taping downstairs at KTOO for Alaska Originals. So it's going to be a television show that's broadcast all over the state of Alaska, which is pretty exciting for us because it's going to be our television debut. And it's a ticketed event. You can get tickets online at harmalaska.com. We're really excited. Been working on our visual elements of it, and we're just really excited to be given this opportunity by KTOO.
Yeah, we're really, really appreciative, and there's plenty of tickets left, and I think you can come in and pay at the door as well if you want to. So if you didn't get a ticket or don't get a ticket, don't feel bad. I think you can probably still make it. 7 o'clock on Saturday at KTOO.
Yeah, Ross McGiles, Alaska Music One's doing sound, and they have some ideas to make our beatbox sound real cool. So
I hope it's going to be real, real fat.
Oh, yeah.
Could you describe a beatbox for me?
No, I'm not the beatboxer. So I don't know how to describe it. It's beautiful rhythms coming out of the mouth of a lovely woman. She's really good. She's among the best drummers, I'm putting air quotes over drummers, that I've ever performed with. She really grounds me and all of us. If I can speak for Annie as well, she keeps great time and it has really interesting rhythms, and she's fabulous.
All right. Thanks so much for coming down today. And you'll be performing tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the University of Alaska Southeast Egan Lecture Hall, and Saturday night here in the 360 Studios. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Thank you so much for having us, and we hope to see a lot of local Juneau people at the shows. I can't wait to meet everyone.
And thanks to UIS for bringing the band down here from Fairbanks. Couldn't have happened without them.
Yes, absolutely.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 3rd of March, 2016. It was on this day, 1875, the opera Carmen appeared on stage for the first time at the Opera Comique in Paris. The audience, shocked by the characters of Carmen, a gypsy girl, and her lover, Don José. Georges Bizet died of a heart attack just 3 months later. Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, published on this date, 1802, the Piano Sonata, number 14 in C-sharp minor, opus 27, number 2. Beethoven wrote the sonata after the untimely death of a close friend, and that's what he thought it was about, and not about moonlight. It's the birthday of Alexander Graham Bell, Edinburgh, 1847, who, as he was trying to make life easier for the hearing impaired, invented the telephone. It's the birthday of the poet James Merrill, born in New York City, 1926, whose early poetry was formal. But in the late 60s, he started using a Ouija board to communicate with spirits, which led to his epic poem, The Changing Light at Sandover. James Merrill, who did not care about popularity, he said, "Think what one has to do to get a mass audience. I'd rather have one perfect reader. Why dynamite the pond in order to catch that single silver carp?" And it was on this date in 1849 the territory of Minnesota was formed, made up of Minnesota and the Dakotas east of the Missouri River, and became a state in 1858. Here's a poem for today by Howard Nemiroff entitled Lobsters. Here at the Super Duper, in a glass tank supplied by a rill of cold fresh water running down a glass washboard at one end and siphoned off at the other, and so perpetually renewed, a herd of lobster is made available to the customer, who may choose whichever one he wants to carry home and drop into boiling water and serve with a sauce of melted butter. Meanwhile, the beauty of strangeness marks these creatures who move when they do with a slow, vague wavering of claws, the somnambulist's effortless clambering as he crawls over the shell of a dream resembling himself. Their velvet colors, mud red, bruise purple, cadaver green, speckled with black, their camouflage at home, make them conspicuous here in the strong day imitating light, the incommensurable philosophers and at the same time victims herded together in the marketplace, asleep except for certain tentative gestures of their antennae or their imperial claws pegged shut with a whittled stick at the wrist. We inlanders, buying our needful food, pause over these slow, gigantic spiders that spin not. We pause and are bemused, and sometimes it happens that a mind sinks down to the blind abyss in a swirl of sand, goes cold and archaic in a carapace of horn, thinking there's something underneath the world, the flame beneath the pot that boils the water. A poem, Lobsters, by Howard Nemiroff, from The Collected Poems of Howard Nemiroff, published by University of Chicago Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center, now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/diamondpark. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
It's about 25 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned into a Juno afternoon. Our next guest is Patty Hitchens Jopie. She's an artist, and she has oil paintings and sculptures showing this Friday at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. It's called Feathered Feats. Patty, thank you for coming down the station today.
Thank you.
So, obviously, it's a show of birds.
It is. It's birds in various settings, landscapes, mostly in Alaska, some in the Arctic, some here, some landscapes. One is even seated in Hawaii. So it's all different birds.
Why oil?
I love oil painting. I didn't start out as an oil painter. I started out a long time ago with pastels, which I still love, but they bother my health. So I switched to watercolor, then was introduced to oil. For some reason, I thought oil was complicated, and it turns out to be just this wonderful medium that I can work with and blend and get the final feel of what I want to do. So I love oils.
What's the process of creating a picture? Some of your work I've seen looks just about like a photograph. It's
a long process. I'm painting with kind of a theme, and this show is a theme. It's called Feathered Feet, which it's different birds that have migrated or do migrate, and there are miraculous things about these individual birds. The more I delved into the idea of painting birds, I looked and I reference the birds and find details and research. For this show, I even found scientists and photographers all over the world that were studying these birds and had great photographs. So the first process of this type of show is to get good reference photographs, and preferably a lot of photographs of birds, because they come in different color phases, and where they are geographically kind of dictates what they look like. So I had to be careful for this show. And as I said, a lot of these birds come to Alaska, and I've kind of made note in my show, so it's my show's educational as well. But the whole process, you know, gathering the material, researching the background and getting those painted on, and then working over and over. I layer oils, so sometimes there's 4, 5, 6 layers of transparent colors in there that kind of bring out the feathers and the background of the. And then, of course, it's a long process to let everything dry and set up, so oil paintings take a long time, and this show has been in the process of a year now of putting it together.
I was talking with somebody about painting and mixing colors, and they said, just be careful that you don't mix too many colors together, because they'll just end up with brown.
That's true, or muddy gray.
Tell me about your sculptures.
My sculptures, I've always dabbled sculpturing. I think I love sculpting more than anything, but it's harder and it's messier, and I don't have a place to do it. I can't really do it in the living room. So I don't do that many, but I do stone and wood, and this show has 5 sculptured pieces in it, an eagle, 2 ravens, one is a big piece of yellow cedar. I got a big piece of yellow cedar from a gentleman off of Prince of Wales Island, and when we cut it, it just fit my show. When I do sculptures, I get rocks, or I get a piece of wood, and I look at it, and my husband thinks I'm nuts, because eventually it'll tell me what it wants to be. So this piece of yellow cedar just happened to emerge as 2 long wings sticking up in the air, kind of like tern wings, you know, how long they are. And so it evolved from that, and that's one of the sculptures, is just a pair of wings out of yellow cedar.
You seem to have a message with your art. In fact, you have narratives that go along with the pictures.
Yes, I do. This show in particular, you know, it features birds, but each of these birds has a peculiarity about them. The more I looked into the type of birds, I started looking at shorebirds and the birds that dominated Juneau, and it kind of spread out from there. And I discovered the Alaska Science Center is researching a lot of these birds for one reason or another. So it just became amazing to me that these birds are being studied for the transmittance of avian flu from South Pacific to Alaska. The transmittance of radioactive nucleides from Japan to Alaska, because they're spending their winters in these other places, and of course they bring back those things with them. So I have these little feet, that's why I call my show Feathered Feet, F-E-A-T-S, and I have these little bits of information at the show for people to read, so it's kind of an educational show. But the purpose of it is I want people to see the interconnectivity of these birds that we all enjoy with the rest of the world. Some of these birds are being studied as an environmental indicator. The little murrelets that are dying off in Alaska, they're studying those. And as the climate changes, they're moving from one place. You know, they're moving further north. They're moving further inland. So these birds are very fascinating, all of them. And I learned a lot. So, yeah, it's kind of a theme-based show. And my next theme, I'm already working on my next show, which deals with the intertidal zone between here and Haines and how that is changing through landscapes. And I hope to depict a message in my paintings that people can not only enjoy my paintings, but they can learn a little bit at the same time.
I'm talking with Patty Hutchins-Chopey about her show at the Jack starting March 4th. Holly is show accompanying your work, doesn't she?
Yes, Holly Denton has the other. We're sharing the gallery at the Jack, so she has some wonderful drawings that she's done. She does pen and ink, a little bit of pointillism in there, so there's some fascinating drawings. So it's a good show, and even though our works are not collaborative, they kind of give sustenance to each other in the show. So if they come by, you'll see two distinct artists there at the show that opens tomorrow.
And the big question, what are you serving for food?
Oh, that is up to the staff over there. They always kind of surprise us. But since I have birds, I decided, and I think I'll have a fair amount of little kids coming to see my show because I know a lot of kids under the age of 7 because of my grandchildren. I went and got a bunch of peeps. So we have free peeps at my show, little birds, to go along with my bird paintings.
What are the hours? It starts about 4:30?
Yeah, it starts at 4:30, runs till about 7, and then, of course, the show will be up through March.
Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Just that if you miss the show for some reason and can't get to see it, I have my studio out on Glacier Spur Road. It's just before you get to the forests out there as you go to the visitor center, and people can stop by. I'm open on Sundays, open more in the summer because we get a lot of walkers that go by our house. So I'm always like to visit with people and have people stop in the studio and see what I'm up to. And I've had so many paintings now, I think this summer they're going to boil out into the outside of the house. So you will see.
Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. Patty Hutchins, Jopey, all one word, .com.
All right, thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
This is Bird Note. To find out if a crow can recognize an individual human face, Professor John Marsleff of the University of Washington bought a caveman mask. He wore the mask while trapping, banding, and then releasing 7 crows on campus. He describes what happened later when he walked through the campus wearing the mask.
And man, it was automatic. I had a big group of birds on me scolding and coming at me when I wore that caveman mask. You know, they scolded mostly close to where we had caught the birds initially, but over time that spread and we had more and more birds involved scolding us. And typically after a couple years of doing the walking, no more trapping, we would have about 50% of the birds we encounter scold us. So the knowledge that this is a strange-looking and dangerous face seemed to be spreading through time and space, and that suggested pretty strongly that they indeed were keyed in on this face, because when we wore the other mask or no mask at all, we did not get this sort of response by the birds.
Talk about never forgetting a face. Marsleff and his team conducted more detailed experiments using realistic faces and new locations. They found the birds could identify the threatening people. As for how and why the crows spread the information?
I think it's one of the, if not the most important function of a mob. It's a benefit to survival to point out and recognize challenges in your environment.
Stress can affect your health in many ways. Whether it's trouble at school, job pressure, economic strain, or a personal trauma, know that you are not alone. There is free confidential help available 24 hours per day at 877-294-0074. If you or someone you love is in need of support, call the search helpline at 877-294-0074.
It's 35 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into a Juno Afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm your host, filling in today for Joan Pardis, who's in, under the weather. In the studio with me now is Aaron Davidman and Amy Houck, today to talk about Wrestling Jerusalem, which is going on tonight at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. Thanks for coming by the station today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Dave, a little bit of your theatrical background, please.
Well, I'm sort of a theater lifer. I was introduced to the theater world here in Juno a few years back when I directed a play, actually for Perseverance Theater, called The Road Weeps, The Well Runs Dry, by a good friend and colleague of mine, Marcus Gardley. And since then, Art Roach, the artistic director, and I have been talking a little bit about my play, Wrestling Jerusalem, which I've written and performed, which is touring all over the country now. And Art thought it would be a timely piece to bring up for a week as a special event. And here we are.
How did the play first come about?
It was actually a commission from an artistic director in Washington, D.C. named Ari Roth, who is now the artistic director of Mosaic Theater of D.C. And he was interested in looking at the American Jewish perspective on the Israel-Palestine conflict.
It's a one-man show.
It's a solo performance. It is.
Is that a lot of pressure on you, or is it a takeaway, big deal about communicating with the other actors on the stage?
It's a tight wire act for sure. Yeah, we're coming up, we're closing in on our 90th performance, I think, coming up soon. I say our because I'm on tour with my technical director and stage manager, Wolfgang Vokalovsky, And so the piece gets easier as I do it, but it's still a very intensive experience for me to perform. I play 17 different characters and myself as I tell the story of my own journey to Israel and Palestine as an American Jew, trying to understand the nuance and complexities of the conflict, meeting a whole range of different people, and then transforming into them as they tell their stories.
Now, when you mention Israel or Palestine, the normal person, they think have a lot of thoughts in their head about what it's like there. What kind of surprised you when you went there?
Well, I've been going there on and off for a decade, and I would just say that everybody in Israel and Palestine has an amazing story to tell. And they want to share their personal perspective and their personal lives in a way that's much more, you know, complicated than what we read in the headlines, you know, what we read in the paper, what comes across in the headlines. And so I thought it was an imperative for me as a writer to really look for the humanity in all these different stories and these different perspectives, and put them all together in a kind of a tapestry of a piece, and that's what the play really is.
What do you keep learning from people when they talk to you after the play?
Well, I learned that people are really broken up about this issue. It's a pretty heated topic in our culture, and I learned that people find hope in the truth, and they find hope in the subtleties that lie inside the hearts of the people that are really suffering, and the characters in my play, tell their stories, they're really creating an experience in the room as theater can do at its best, as opposed to just a public official we might see on TV, or someone on a book tour who maybe has written a book about the topic, or maybe a former someone who had been in the military. In other words, when we have public gatherings around this topic, it's often a fairly sort of heady experience. And what I've tried to do in writing this play is create something that's more emotional, that's more spiritual, that people can really, in a sense, go on the journey that I took with me.
Amy, tell me more about the place, the run. It's going to be at the Jack tonight?
Yes. So we open tonight at 7:30 at the Jack, and there will be three other performances Friday night,
at 7:30, and then Saturday, Sunday at 2 p.m. And the show is being co-presented by Perseverance Theater and also three other local organizations, and we've worked together to bring Aaron here, and that's Congregation Sukkot Shalom, Juno, People for Peace and Justice, and Northern Light United Church.
Aaron, when people talk to you after the play, what has surprised you most? What kind of comment, is there a comment that really lives with you?
Well, what's interesting, I should say, is that after every performance, there is a facilitated conversation. So it's not just that they talk to me, but actually we have a facilitator, and we're doing that here every night as well. Wonderful local facilitators each night are going to help guide the audience in a community dialogue. And this is different than just a Q&A where people just ask me questions, but rather they get to talk with each other and they get to debrief the experience with the facilitator. And I think what surprises me most is how a room full of people can experience the same thing so differently. So they're, on the one hand, they're encountering these different kinds of characters that they might not have met, but they're also encountering each other as an audience, as they witness each other reflecting back on an experience that they just had. And I think that's fascinating. I think it says a lot about the true diversity of opinion in our culture. And how, we're living in such a polemical time right now. This play really stands for nuance and multiplicity, as I've already said, and invites people to try to hold multiple perspectives in themselves.
Is it for kids?
It's not really for kids. I think it's about I would say high school and up, so 14 and up.
Amy, could you please remind me what the show times are?
Sure. Tonight at 7:30, tomorrow at 7:30, Saturday and Sunday at 2 p.m., and you can get tickets at ptalaska.org or at the Jack at the door or by calling 463-TIXS.
Amy Hulk and Aaron Davidman, thank you very much for coming down to the station. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I just think it's theater... live storytelling in theater is always a rich way to spend an afternoon or an evening. So come on down.
Beth Yaron, you are tuned into a Juno afternoon. Our next guests in the station are here to talk about not-so-silent films at the Gold Town. Go ahead, Costa, could you please introduce our guests?
We should do the whole thing in pantomime, since it's silent. That would be awesome radio right there. Joining us in the studio today, we have Miles and Karina. They have come all the way from Seattle. An arduous journey of many, many hours.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And they were here last year in June.
Yeah.
And they played to a movie we had called Prince Ahmed, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, which was awesome. And they're back again to do our next not-so-silent film, which is my favorite thing that we do of all in the entire city.
Yay.
Other than bears. So bears, you guys. But bears at a distance, you guys up close.
That sounds great.
That's a difference. So they're going to be playing to this incredible Buster Keaton film, Steamboat Bill Jr. It's made in 1926.
Eight.
Let's go with eight because the general was 27, and this was after it.
Oh, right. Okay.
And they'll be doing a live original score to the film, and they, since this is radio and you can't see, even though Mr. Scott Burton is recording this on video. Hi, friends. They have their instruments here, and so they might play a little bit of What to Expect.
Yeah, we'll play a tiny excerpt when you give us the... Go ahead.
Well, excerpt away.
Okay, here we go. Very short one, so you'll just have to imagine what's happening.
Should we move this down?
Oh, yeah.
We have the technology to get closer.
We're just going to... yeah, okay. All right.
So just before we first see Steamboat Bill... So that isn't actually how it goes.
Do you look at the film for numerous times before you, or is it just once or twice and you feel like you got it?
Well, when we are commissioned to write a score for a film, we spend a lot of time with the film, months,
probably
actually.
About watched it probably 50 or 60 times in composing it, about 50 times at least.
At least. That might be more than I've seen it.
It's but we still love it. That's the cool thing is, and it's funny too because there's certain points that I have never seen because I have to look down or change instruments, and I know that you have that same thing, Miles, where I'll see you look up when I've done something funny and you didn't see what the little sound went to because you're busy concentrating on the fingering. Anyhow, so I've seen it many times, but not completely while we're playing.
Do you just find something that attracts you visually and then go from there?
Yes. Would you like to answer that one?
Well, when we're commissioned to write a score for a film, we watch it and we actually make notes. We'll write down all the scene changes and the mood changes, and oftentimes we'll attach an adjective or a word to it or a couple of words together. For example...
Frightening.
Yes.
Sad.
Frightening misogynism or something, and then we'll just write music that I just made that up. Some kind of musical thing that evokes that sort of feeling and a mood, because music has that great power of instilling a mood into you. And then we'll just write everything down. Some days when we're actually composing, if we get, I don't know, 20 or 30 seconds of music, we're really excited. It's kind of like doing animation. If you get 6 seconds of animation in a day when you're making that, then you're happy.
Yeah, and the film itself, I think in particular when you're doing, maybe not in particular to Buster Keaton, but I think there's his films are so evocative, and I think you can watch them and you're hearing things. I mean, I am anyway because I hear voices, but you're hearing things in your head anyhow.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the soundtrack of my brain.
I had a feeling.
Discordant, modal, and in a minor key. But he's just so evocative, and I don't know how you can narrow down where to go. Like, he's so...
Oh, yeah. There's so much movement and so many things.
So frenetic.
In this one, quite a few of the scenes, we are providing more of an overall, like a sound that's kind of underneath the action, not exemplifying every single little thing, because you don't want to take away from the film. You just want to support it. But in the ending scene, when it gets very storm-like, we do punctuate quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. So for those who don't know, Steamboat Bill Jr. is... it's one of his feature-length films. Buster Keaton directed it more or less, even though he's not credited. And it also stars William Torrance, who's a very big silent film star at the time. Mm-hmm. And he's a college guy who's coming home to visit a father he's never really known, who's a steamboat captain. And this giant windstorm sweeps through. And this is the film that has possibly one of the most iconographic images of the silent film era, of the house front that falls onto him, and he's standing in the window, the open window, so it falls around him. It was an extremely dangerous stunt, which he almost died doing. he was off his mark by about a centimeter. Anyway, it's a super, super well-known bit of film, but that end sequence, and it's quite long, that storm sequence.
Yeah.
His physical comedy is incredible. Exemplary.
It's incredible.
Can't be touched. And it's still hilarious.
It is hilarious. It's a completely enjoyable film, and it's he's so interesting to look at. He's just, he's
the stone face of comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a consummate performer. I was just writing a little Facebook thing on him, and you know, he started in vaudeville as a baby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. His parents were fairly well-known vaudevillians. They were the Brown family, I think. The Keaton family, and he had, as a baby, they had a special contraption for him. It was a harness that he wore. I mean, as a baby, an infant, it had a handle on it. And they would regularly, part of their act was picking up this handle and throwing him across the stage into things, onto things. So that was how he grew up.
Knowing how to fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And get up again.
I want to thank you for coming down to the station and playing a little bit of music.
All right.
Not-So-Silent Film, which is happening this weekend.
It is. It is tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. There's actually four shows, so no excuses. Friday at 7 p.m., Saturday at 4 p.m., Sunday at 4 p.m., and 6 p.m. Tickets are, you can go to our website, goldtownnick.com. We have family prices. It's an awesome thing to take your kids to.
Yes.
Yes.
And if anyone out there has a viola we can borrow, please call me.
All right, thanks for coming.
Thanks, Jeff.
AWARE is proud to announce the 2016 Women of Distinction. Congratulations to Marie Darlin, Justine Munch, Missouri Smythe, and Christy West. We'll celebrate the honorees at the 20th annual Women of Distinction Gala and Silent Auction on March 5th at Centennial Hall. For tickets, call AWARE at 586-6623 or go online at thejackoraware.org.
The March Barn Dance is this Saturday, March 5th, 7:30 p.m. at St. Anne's Parish off 5th Street downtown. Uncle John's String Band will provide live music and Odette Edgar will teach and call conference square dances. No experience or partners are necessary. The steps are easy, the people are friendly, and the music is lively. Show up ready to dance and smile a lot. Discounts for students and seniors, free for JVs and AmeriCorps, sponsored by Juno Folk Dancers with help from KTOO. Barn Dance, Saturday.
All right, we're on the air with Nancy DeCherney here to talk about various things going on in the community.
Let's just do First Friday right away.
Okay.
Because it sounds like you've already hit quite a few of the hot spots. We've got over at the Jack, and that's where you should start so you can get your little flyer. We have two artists, and I believe you just were speaking with Patty earlier on. So we have Holly Denton and Feathered Feats by Patty Hutchins-Dupia. It's a shared show, and it's beautiful. Come on over, get your little flyer. You guys have Walkabout by Jerry Smetzer, and it looks like you're actually going to be open. So
just for an hour.
Just for an hour.
From 4 to 5.
4 to 5, okay. So stop in here. Over at COPA, Monica Dougherty is hanging. Not herself personally, but her artwork. And, of course, you can get a little ice cream while you're over there so you have courage and strength to walk and do the rest of it because it's a big route today. Sketch, which if you don't know where the Sketch Studio is, if you go to up Main Street and you look at Kenny's Walkin' Teriyaki, and there's a parking lot there, in through the parking lot, you'll see a little door, and that's M.K. McNaughton's Sketch Studio. So stop in there. She has here and there. The Juno Douglas City Museum has its 12th annual community art 12x12. So everything is on a 12x12 piece of framing or something, surface, and it's called Let's Get Emotional, so everything is very emotional. Yeah, okay.
Don't mention it like that.
All right. And now over at Mountainside Wellness, she's doing a film showing, Racing Extinction. That'll be at 7 p.m. So go there after you've gone through all of the other things that you can do. On Front Street, Annie Kales has artwork by Kathleen Wiest, Southeast by Southwest, Living in Two Worlds. She usually lives in Tenneke, but she also has a space, a winter home in Arizona now. So, and plus, she's making pottery jars. So come out and see Annie Kale's show. Alaska Robotics has a new artist. She's not really new to town, but she's relatively new to town, Christina Fenner. They will have her show up through March, but stop in so you can meet her. She's at Alaska Robotics. Sea Alaska Heritage will be open. They'll have Tony Weber, Gail Davalitz, and Renee Culp. And it's free to get in. If you haven't made it into the Sobolov building yet, you need to go and see that. It's just fabulous. It smells wonderful, for one thing. The Rookery Cafe has At the Art of It. It's a family show, the Wayne family and their multimedia show. They will be, it's oils and acrylics and all sorts of wonderful things. At the Rookery, the Canvas has new works by Jeff Douglas, and he's got a whole bunch of watercolor washes. And then Aunt Claudia's Doll has recently done a museum expansion. They'll be open Friday from 2 to 7, Saturday from noon till 5. They are inviting you to take a selfie with any stuffed toy that is below knee level. I don't know. Is that a knee selfie? Plus, they'll have tea and cookies being served by micro miniature ivory elephants. So this should be fun. If you've not been to the Doll Museum, it's above Hearthside Books, but you get to it on the Franklin Street side. Kindred Post has March Madness photo booth from 4:30 to 7:30. There's a photo booth with photographer Conrad Frank, and there will be live music with Liz and Leif Sea, and snacks. It's always good to get that in there. Rainforest Yoga, Lindsay Kirchhoff from 5:15 to 6:15, in case you need to stretch out a little bit. Juno Artist Gallery has an artist search. They're looking for new co-op members, so stop in there. They'll be open until 9. They will have treats, and they're looking, if you're interested in becoming a part of the Juno Co-op, stop in. Also in the Senate Mall, author Rich Ritter has a new book out, and he will be doing signings. I believe there's a signing at Hearthside Books, too, but I don't have that information right here. And also, the Juno at the Baranoff Hotel Bubble Room, the Juno Lyric Opera is doing a little preview party of The Man of La Mancha. So stop in there between 4:30 and 6:30. They'll have people singing hits from the song, from the show, which is coming right up. And the director and the set designer will be there. And there's a no-host bar. And they'll be giving away tickets. And there'll be some surprises. And it should be fun.
So one of the other authors at the Hearthside is Larry Johansson.
Oh, that's right.
Finding Juno's beautiful pictures of Juno.
I knew we had something else going on. Do we have any time to talk about anything else?
We have about a minute to go.
Okay. Well, we have a chamber music concert at Northern Light Theater on Saturday night. There's, as you've talked about, the Jerusalem, Wrestling Jerusalem this weekend. A lot of stuff happening. We'll touch base with you next week, I think, to get the full on in the next room. Man of La Mancha, Juno's Got Talent, Symphony Showcase, Wonderheads. So much to go. Lots to do.
Thank you.
We'll see you there.
Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
The forecast for tonight, light rain and snow early in the evening, then scattered rain and snow showers, little or no snow accumulation expected. Low temperatures around 34 degrees. Forecast for Friday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow in the morning, then a chance of rain in the afternoon. High temperatures around 39 degrees. Friday night, numerous rain showers. Saturday, mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers. Saturday night, mostly cloudy skies, low temperatures around 34 degrees.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas.